I've always been an entrepreneur at heart. My name is Elon Jacobson, and deal making is in my DNA. I'll be here each week talking with entrepreneurs and deal makers about the crazy obstacles they've faced along their paths, and whether it's nature or nurture driving their success. Expect the unexpected on a Dealmaker's DNA. All right, welcome back everyone to another episode of a Dealmaker's DNA. I got a really fun one, and I know I say that very often, but I got a really fun one because I happen to know this next guest quite well. We have Stephanie Shapiro. Steph is the Executive Vice President at Phase 3, COO of Together We Stand Foundation, which I'm sure we'll talk a lot about. And previous life spent 10 years working for the federal government in HR. So a pretty eclectic background. Steph is also an avid coffee drinker and wine drinker. And she blogs about her experiences with motherhood and mental illness at mamaneedsavodka.com. So Steph, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Ellen.
So this one's going to be a little bit awkward because I'm going to have to ask you some questions I know the answers to, but I know that others don't. So it wouldn't make sense to just jump right in. I got to keep this consistent and then, you know, get to know you a little better and get the audience to know you a little better so they can understand kind of how you turn into you. So maybe you could just take me back. You know, I know you have some great stories about learning about business around the kitchen table, but take me back to what that childhood looked like and the first years, the formative years of your life that led you to kind of the next phase of your business life.
I think a few things were really integral. I think part of it is to be honest, my family history. All four of my grandparents were survivors of the Holocaust, and all four of them came to the country with $0 in their pocket and zero family. So growing up, the value of family and the value of hard work, but also appreciating what we had and what the country had to offer us was really deeply ingrained in us. We didn't take anything for granted. And we certainly didn't have more than we needed because we understood how lucky we were to just have what we had. It very much shaped who my dad was. He's one of the hardest working individuals that I know with a very entrepreneurial spirit. And what I loved about him is that exactly what you said, he brought that home to the table every day. He never treated my sister and I like we were children. He never spoke down to us. He would bring the issues of the day, especially when it came to people and culture issues within the business. He would bring them to the table. And as young as being 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, he would bring up HR issues and say, what do you think I should do? How do you think I should talk to my people about this and make this better? And even when it came to business decisions, like we're thinking about buying a business in Europe, what do you think about this? And it really started training my sister and I to think so much further outside of the box than we would have been exposed to as young kids.
You know, you mentioned something about taking for granted, you know, living in a country like Canada. I do it all the time because like we live here and I have some complaints about what's going on right now, but let's leave those aside. You know, I think that Canada is one of the greatest countries in the world. Was that always instilled in you, like how lucky you were to be born in a place like Canada?
Yeah. I mean, my grandparents grew up in countries that did not allow them to have family. They grew up in countries that did not allow them to prosper in business, to practice religion, to practice politics, to have any rights and freedoms. It was dictated to them. And ultimately, they were driven out of their own countries. So these, what people think are simple freedoms that we have, being able to go to the grocery store and buy whatever we want, whenever we want it, being able to put our children on school buses and not have to worry about their safety, being able to live in a country where we have a democracy and whether it always works properly is a different story here, but have a democracy where we get a say in what our lives look like. So many people, they've been here generation after generation. This is how life always was. That's not what life looked like for my family. And we are a significantly smaller family because of it, because generations have been wiped out. So to have those things, you know, to be able to vote regularly, to be able to know that I live in a country where I don't have to fear for my life in any circumstance, that those were instilled in us at very early ages, not in a way to make us fear, but to genuinely appreciate what we have and want to be able to contribute to that within our country and make sure that's sustainable for generations to come.
And I know this will dovetail really nicely into Together We Stand, but I'm going to leave that for now. Talk to me about that transition. You're around the kitchen table. You're learning from an incredible entrepreneur. I know your father. Why did you land up in HR, government? You know, it's so common you find that, you know, children of entrepreneurs kind of just go down that path originally. You know, I know you've come back to that now, but talk to me about that early part of your career and what led you in that direction.
I think a couple of different things, and it really speaks to where I am now. Part of it was the interest that I had, the various passions that I had, and part of it was who I was as a person at the time. To be fully transparent, I always wanted to become a teacher or a principal. I always wanted to get into education, and I spent my education in child psychology, really wanted to go down the path of becoming a high school or elementary school principal, and then I spent a number of hours volunteering in the classroom to qualify for that and realized I really don't enjoy spending time with children.
Yep.
You know, I tried to think about like the psychology of people, the psychology of kids, the psychology of adults. How do I bring that more to an adult-centric world? And really, that's what led me down the path of HR. Again, I was so lucky to grow up. I grew up working for my dad. I didn't go to summer camp. So every extra hour that I had from the age of 14 on, I was exposed to different parts of his business. I helped out in the warehouse. I helped out in the credit department. I answered phones, and ultimately I landed in HR and realized that I had a tremendous passion for this because it was a study in how do I make people more successful? How do I make the bottom line more successful using human psychology? And so I loved that so much. I think the reason that I ended up in government is because at the time I grew up to be a very timid person. I grew up to be a person who really liked to stay within my safety bubble and my safety net. And a government job where I had the security and they would afford me all of the training and a lot of time to get to know my career and to get to know my craft was really appealing to me. And I grew a tremendous amount during that time because they did invest so much time in my development. And I think a lot of other organizations that are private organizations don't always take that time, or certainly didn't 15 years ago when I was doing this. The nature of business has shifted in investing in people. There were not a lot of organizations that were doing that 15 years ago. So it was really appealing to me.
So I want to talk about this idea of, you know, radically changing oneself. You know, you mentioned growing up very timid. A lot of people who don't know me don't know that I'm actually a fairly quiet person in my.
You keep telling me that, but I've yet to say that.
I know. And I was a very, very shy child. And like you, I've been through a pretty radical transformation of, you know, finding myself and coming to terms with who I am and gaining confidence and bravery and all the things that kind of come with that. Talk to me about that journey, because I, you know, hearing you talk about it, and I know you as a very powerful woman, you mentioned that wasn't always the case. So talk to me about what that looked like for you.
You know, it's really interesting, and it really does connect with mental health for me, which is why I'm so passionate about it. Growing up, I think there were some underlying mental health issues that I had, and there are mental health issues that run genetically in my family, but I don't think I was able to identify them. And about 4 years ago, right after I had my youngest, I got diagnosed with bipolar disorder and went through a tremendous amount of trauma and turmoil as I was getting the diagnosis, trying to figure out how to treat it. And I found myself at sort of the lowest of the low and found myself feeling very vulnerable, questioning who I was. And I think when you go through trauma sometimes, and I think when you go through a point of being at a really low point, you stop being afraid of what could happen. You're like, because now it's empowering. Now you're like, I've seen the worst. I've been through the worst. What could possibly happen to me now? And you're much more open to taking risk. And you're much more open to not really worrying about people pleasing everybody else. You are much more self-aware and aware of your capabilities when you are able to come out of a situation like that and overcome it. So I think there's a lot of, you know, I really attribute a lot of the changes and a lot of the fearlessness that I experience now to the fact that I did go through a pretty traumatizing time in my life and I overcame it.
You know, I couldn't agree more with you. I think adversity creates a much larger band of understanding. And, you know, shit doesn't feel that difficult when you know what difficult feels like, right? And if you don't have an understanding of the bottom, you could think that, relatively speaking, something that shouldn't be that negatively impactful feels way more than it should be if you have a far better understanding of that bottom. You know, one of the things that I speak about when I'm recruiting for our team is I always want to understand the biggest adversities someone's gone through. And one of the reasons is because I think that people that have gone through adversity, I trust more because, you know, they've kind of proven themselves. What's your view on kind of the human side? I mean, you have 10 years experience in HR. Is adversity a good thing? How do you, how do you look at that? How do you look for that in people? How can you ask that in a tactful way, unlike myself?
I think, you know, it's funny. It comes with, I talk a lot about vulnerability in the workplace. And to me, I'm a huge advocate of that. And it's not necessarily that somebody has to have overcome so much adversity, but they have to be willing to be vulnerable enough to talk about themselves in that way, to talk about maybe some of the traumas that they've experienced in their lives, or perhaps some of the weaknesses that they have and have had to overcome. Because it's, to me, if I can spot vulnerability in someone, and a lot of people look at vulnerability as a bad thing. They're like, oh, I don't want to be vulnerable, or there's a kind of this like negative stigma towards it. And to me, vulnerability within the workplace is where the magic happens, because that's when people are not afraid to take risks. They become a little bit more fearless. They are more inclined to be creative, because they're not afraid to fail or to be told, you know, maybe that's not a great idea, or to try it anyways, in spite of that.
Explain that to me, because I think most people would equate vulnerability, and I couldn't agree more with you. I totally agree, because I'm a huge advocate of authenticity and self-awareness. And I think that plays, very symbiotically with this idea of vulnerability. But I think a lot of people would classify, you know, if you're in a state of vulnerability, that you're fearful. And your comment is you actually act more fearless. Why is that?
Because I think to be vulnerable is to be brave. I think to open yourself. I think that anytime somebody walks into a room, and I think this is one of the best qualities in any leader that I've ever seen. If a leader can walk into a room and in a meeting full of individuals be asked a question and say, I actually don't know the answer to that. I think that's so powerful. Because now it allows the rest of that team to feel that they can feel the same way, to say, I don't know the answer to that, but I'm going to find out. It allows people to maybe not feel stupid in the workplace. It allows people to say, I have an idea. I think that when a leader can walk into a room and say, I'm going through a really hard time right now, guys. This is how it's impacting me. I need to rely on you a little bit more. It brings such a human aspect to the workplace. And I think that's where people are driven to do some of their best work, because they buy into you as a person, right? So that's kind of how I feel about.
Totally. I mean, like from my perspective, whether people know it or they don't know it, it's super obvious when someone on the other end of the conversation is being real with you, right? Like subconsciously, you know, if someone's being real or not, whether they know it or don't know it, subconsciously, people want to be led by someone who's real. Right. I mean, I don't go into politics, but you look at someone like Trump and people don't understand why he was elected. He believes his own bullshit, whether you agree with him or not. Right. And he at least believes it.
He's unapologetically himself.
Unapologetically. Right. And we can debate all day long whether that's good or bad. But the point is that, you know, the realness is incredibly magnetic. So when you say someone walks into a room and says, I don't know, that is putting themselves in a place of vulnerability. So I totally understand that. So talk to me about this transition, government, HR, doing what I know you do now. And I know we're going to jump into Together We Stand. What was that transition like? Why did it happen? Where were you in your life when you decided to make that change?
I was bored. And I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I just knew I didn't want to be doing what I was doing. And it was a really hard decision to leave my place of work, because I was with the government and people thought I was crazy. They're like, you have a pension. You have the most secure job in the entire world. But at the end of the day, I wasn't being fulfilled. because as much as I support our fellow public servants who do a lot of good for this world, there's not a lot of flexibility and creativity allowed. It's very, you know, systematic and process driven, and nothing gets done quickly. I was ready for a change. I was hungry for more. My dad, at the exact same time, it was a bit of kismet, at the exact same time was retiring from the lumber industry. And he also didn't know what he wanted to do with the rest of his life. He just knew he wanted to focus on areas that were important to him. He wanted to have more impact on the world, and he wanted to do good. And he wanted to take me with on that journey. And we said, okay, let's see what phase three is going to be. Phase three right now is going to be all about Rick's passion projects. And some of that is politics, and some of that is advocacy work, and some of that is figuring out how to take his investments, make money in order to put more money into doing good into the world and his philanthropic endeavors. And he kind of just threw me in, and I knew none of it, you know, and it was taking that step to be like, all right, I'm just going to see what I can do here. I'm just going to be completely open to the fact that I don't know what I don't know. I don't have these skills, but I'm willing to learn them. And I'm willing to see if there's other areas of interest for me. And some of it, you know, I'm so lucky. I'm so glad that I did it. I helped manage his investment portfolio for a while. I hated every single day of it.
I was going to say, that doesn't sound like that'd be very fulfilling for you.
No, I hated every single day of it, but I'm so glad I did it because it brought me a skill set and a language that I wouldn't have otherwise had. And as he stood up, him and my mom decided that they wanted to create this charitable organization to help military families. Again, this wasn't necessarily something that I was so super interested in. I didn't know anything about it. He just said, do me a favor, I need some help running this. And the more that I dug in, the more that I just loved to learn. And again, it was at this pivotal point in my life where I had gone through so much adversity. And I just wanted to say yes to every single opportunity. I realized that I had been going through life. I wasn't living life. I was just going through life. I was going through the motions. And I needed to start saying yes. And I needed to start saying, I needed to start being open to opportunities that were presented in front of me. And because of that, I have now found an incredible passion that has opened the door to meeting an entirely new demographic of individuals, of traveling the country that I had not seen before, of getting, you know, getting to be able to public speak in front of individuals, develop skill sets that I never knew that I had, refine skill sets that I had, but was too afraid to kind of push myself towards. So it was, the transition was a really powerful time in my life. For the first time ever, I was saying yes, instead of being afraid and saying no and picking the safe route.
Power of yes is real. I think that people hold them. Yeah, I think the thing that holds people back the most in life is themselves. And they may not even know it, or may not even understand that they're doing it. But fear and saying no and not wanting to be comfortable is a very dangerous thing if you want to become the best version of yourself. Let's jump into the Together We Stand. Obviously, it's a charity I know about. I know how passionate you are. You know, I want you to talk about what you do because I think it's really interesting. But I first want to talk about the connection. You know, we started this conversation talking about Canada and how it's the greatest country in the world. One of the things we do extremely poorly is support our armed forces. There really isn't a strong connection. You know, I look down south. I mean, every time I'm at an airport, there's a procession of people, you know, waiting for some soldiers to get back from who the hell knows where. And, you know, when you first started talking to me about the charity, I'm like, I don't know a single person who's ever served. And I think that that's the majority of Canadians. So maybe talk to me about the relationship you think Canada has with their armed forces and what may be broken, because I've imagined you would think there is some level of brokenness there. And then B, you know, what Together We Stand is trying to do and accomplish.
I think, you know, going back to what's broken and why Canada doesn't have this awareness, I think it also depends on where you live. And that's something that I've realized.
That's
too
fair. Yeah.
I've grown up in a Toronto bubble. I knew no one that served. I had a very small network of individuals, and there's not a very large military presence in Toronto. If you are living in Oromocto in Nova Scotia, if you are living in Victoria in BC, the Navy is right there. The Army is right there. It's ingrained in the community. So it depends on where you live.
But the vast majority of Canadians live in these densely populated places.
Yes. So I agree with that. So, and I think a couple of things. I think number one, we are not like the United States. We're not funneling a tremendous amount of dollars into our armed forces. And I think a part of that is because of our Canadian politics and because there's this adverse nature and thinking about the military, because we don't want to talk about war. We don't want to talk about conflict. But the reality is that, you know, our Canadian Armed Forces members and their families and veterans have done so much more than simply serve when there's conflict. Yes, we were in Afghanistan. Yes, we were in World War I, World War II, and Korea. But when you think about it from what our Canadian Armed Forces members do, just from a domestic side of things, we're involved in search and rescue missions in the Arctic, in the mountains, in the oceans. If there are ships that are in trouble, it's our search and rescue individuals in the Canadian Armed Forces that are going out and are on call 24 hours a day. When there was flooding just recently in Abbotsford in BC, it was our members that were on the ground helping out with those rescue missions. When there are forest fires, you know, in the prairies, it's our armed forces that are called on. When we had a COVID-19 crisis and we couldn't get vaccines out fast enough, it was our Canadian Armed Forces that were brought in to help them with the logistics of that. It's our Canadian Armed Forces that are fighting cybersecurity threats on a daily basis for us. So I think...
I mean, that's really interesting, because I have to tell you, when I think about armed forces, I always think about abroad. And it's a great point that people don't think or maybe don't know about how much they do domestically.
You know, and I bring it back to, here's what they're doing for us at home. Here's what they're doing for us abroad. If those things weren't in place, what would our country look like? And why I'm so passionate about it is because I can say I know what our country would look like because that's where my grandparents grew up. I'm intimately aware of what happens if we don't have these safeties and protections in place that we take for granted and are so far in the back of our minds, but are playing such a prominent role. You know, it's interesting with me because when I look at causes, you often think of causes as very niche. Sure, I support breast cancer. Why do I support breast cancer? Because I knew somebody who had breast cancer or I had an experience with it. Yes, I support sick kids because my child was there and they took such good care of me or I knew somebody. When people think of the Canadian Armed Forces, when people think about military and military causes, they're like, that's not really relevant to me. What does that have to do with me? What we really need to realize is it very much has to do with us. It plays a huge impact in our day-to-day as Canadian citizens. What we do is a terrible job of PR with that. We don't do a very good job advertising what it is that they do for us to keep us in the privileged life that we have right now.
So talk about Together Where We Stand and what you guys are trying to accomplish and help with.
Sure. We really focus on three pillars. We focus on educating the Canadian population in terms of what the Canadian Armed Forces members do.
Well, you did a good job on that one.
So. We talk and we highlight the fact that their families, the members, the serving members and these veterans, their families play an integral role in the safety and security. Because every single member will tell you, if my family is not holding down the fort at home, if they're not sacrificing the fact that I've missed 8 birthdays, that my spouse has moved 5 different jobs and can't hold down a meaningful career because we've moved across the country 17 times in the last 23 years. If, you know, we've sacrificed holidays and milestones, they're making these sacrifices so that we don't have to as the average Canadian. And so we're really trying to highlight the important role that these families play to the safeties and security, to the recruitment and retention of the Canadian Armed Forces. So that's the education pillar. We also have the acknowledgement and thanks pillar, where all we want is to bring the recognition to these families and as Canadians, say thank you. So we have programs like our Operation Care Package, where we send care packages with cash cards and coupons and thank you messages to families who have a loved one deployed overseas during the holiday seasons. Simply to say, thank you for the sacrifice that you're making. We acknowledge you, we see you. We also have, we created Military Family Appreciation Day. We passed a unanimous consent motion through the House of Commons to create a day for Canada to say thank you to these families. And then we have the support pillar. How do we help families who might be in crisis? We have military families that because of the military journey they're on and the military lifestyle they have chosen to live, there is a need for emergency housing. There's a need for emergency childcare. There's a need for emergency mental health services. And if you can believe it, because of some of the nature of their work, there's a need for food security. There are times where some of our Canadian Armed Forces members and their families or veterans are not able to put food on their table. And so that's how we help support that community. We have these emergency response mechanisms in place for that.
You know, it's awesome. And I think that anyone who wants to support, I would recommend them going to your website, which we will link beside the podcast. You straddle this really interesting area where you're around your family business and your family office that is very capitalistic in nature. And then you are, you know, in this incredibly philanthropic world that you live in. There's a lot of capitalists listening to this podcast. I would imagine most are. And I think to myself all the time, like, what could we be doing even in a small way? You know, a lot of us are not going to be working full time in a foundation like yours, but what is it you think that people could be doing in a small way to give back to whatever cause that they're passionate about? Because I think people don't think about it that often. We're all busy doing stuff, right? It's really easy to be busy doing stuff. But I do think that A, it's important to give back, and B, it feels fucking good. Like, I know for me, like, I'd much rather give to others than receive a gift of my own. Like, I love giving someone a present versus receiving a present, you know? So I think there's something self-serving about serving.
Yeah. I think it's funny. We were literally just having this conversation today because it's all about, you know, to me, my stakeholders are my donors. And in a sense, I'm asking my donors to make an investment in me. Well, why do I want to make an investment? And to me, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're a business owner, if you are a capitalist, understand that by giving back, you can actually kill two birds with one stone. And that's what's so cool about this, is that when you, if you run an organization, if you run a business, you have to understand that in this day and age, it was different back in the generation of our parents where they're like, I have one job, I'm going to stay in that job for 50 years. Or I have one brand of food that I like, and I'm going to stay with that brand forever. I'm never going to make a change. This generation, our generation, and certainly the next generation, are very aware of the products that they're buying and are very aware of the companies that they're working for. They want to know that the company that they work for, that they're going to be recruited by, that they're going to stay with, is giving back to something that they believe in, or that a product that they're consuming is run by a company that does good in the world. They're looking for impact. They're looking for cause. By understanding, if you can attach yourself to a cause that resonates with your consumers or resonates with people you want to recruit and retain, you are not only having impact on that charitable organization and a demographic that might be vulnerable, but you're actually helping the bottom line of your organization. It will help you in your recruitment, in your retention, in people who are buying your product. It will. Like I said, you kill two birds with one stone.
You know how much I love the ROI argument. So that's a good one. So Steph, you know, it's been over half an hour. I told you it'd be half an hour. And thank you once again for joining me. But for those that would like to continue following along on your journey, you know, keeping tabs on not only the organization you work with, but you yourself, what's the best way that they could do that?
You can follow me on LinkedIn. I'm very active on LinkedIn. I would say constantly visit our TWS website because we're constantly evolving. And if you have any desire to hear my thoughts on, you know, motherhood, parenting, and experiences with mental illness and how to navigate that, then follow me on my blog, www.mamaneedsavodka.com. And mama always needs a vodka.
Dada needs a vodka as well. So I'm on the same page. Steph, thank you so much. And until next time.
That's it for this week. If you enjoyed what you heard, rate us and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Until next time, on A Dealmaker's DNA, where you can expect the unexpected.